Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman. Today, I'm joined by a great guest and confidant, Jay Villar. Hey, Jay, how you doing?
I'm good, Aaron. It's good to be back.
It's nice to see you again.
Yeah.
We are in a bit of a different recording spot. We are live recording at our own studio, outside of the studio.
It's very exciting. You can see everything. The rain's coming down. It's not as cold as it, you know, typically was. So enjoying the indoorness of where we're at.
I thought they were going to put us out here because we're tapping kegs, but maybe not. Something else than that, I guess. Maybe it was just a scheduling conflict. But we're here, and it's exciting. So, hey, Jay, a little bit about your background. Jay is the founder and practitioner of Nourish, a bespoke consulting company with a mission to educate, teach, and train people on the benefits of using food to heal your body and optimize your health. Jay has always been at the forefront of using optimal health techniques and biohacking his nutrition to achieve remarkable results in his career. He attributes that success to principles he learned from studying health, nutrition, business principles on increasing your energy, sharpening your mind, and being a more productive human being. Jay recently completed a fellowship at the Rodale Institute, and he now lives in Boston, Massachusetts.
I do.
Hey, I'm getting shorter every time with these. See, I'm kind of pulling out lines here and there.
It's good.
They're on the editing floor, the pre-production editing floor. Hey, let's talk about today's show. I'm quite excited about this. On the show, we have discussed wine, weed, all types of meats, seafood, breads, veg, sweets, savories, and nearly everything else on the table. But what brings it all together better than anything else? What not only pairs with it all, but enhances with every gulp. It's beer, Jay.
Beer.
It's beer. So why is it taking us 66 episodes to talk about beer? I don't know. I am the one to blame. I take full responsibility, but we're here. Bit more on beer. So this magical elixir was spawned in the birthplace of agriculture, society, and culture. The original fermented brew were first stumbled upon back in the 5th millennium BC in Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at least that's the first recorded home brew. There's probably people that did it well before that, but that's when they had it documented. Since then, the process of mixing four simple ingredients of water, malt, hops, and yeast together has been keeping our gut healthy and balanced. It's actually provided an opportunity to have clean drinking water around the world.
That's right.
And it puts smiles on our faces. How about that? What incredible stuff. Maybe a couple fists up on occasion,
it's
too,
like
right?
A little beer buzz.
Yeah, there it is. And as we get older, that keeps our gut getting is balanced for sure, and that's an important part for our microflora. But we also have to watch out for those beer guts. We've got to keep those in check hanging over our belt, right?
Oh, hey. Well, you know, those all have good stories about how they got there.
There you go. I like that. It's like you've earned it, right? Yeah. Okay. So according to, additionally, I'll say, we like to focus on differentiation in food categories on Sourcing Matters. And according to the Brewers Association in 2017, craft brewing sales accounted for 12.7% of the U.S. beer market by volume. Now, that was up from 2007, 10 years prior, where craft brew sales accounted for only 3.8% of the U.S. beer market. So, are you telling me that better food sourced using elevated production standards can't also grow to see similar success? So, supposedly, a chasm in sales is crossed at 13.5%. where market will move from early adopters to early majority. So are we on the cusp of the early majority reaching demand for better quality four-pack pounders at $20 a pop?
Mm.
I think we are. I think that's where they're, right? We're crossing that chasm again there.
Yeah.
Can food mirror that success and get market penetration used to migrate from big box domestic beer to the craft local beer? And the current 6.5% market share of organics in the next decade, I mean, effectively, that would mean that our growth trends would quadruple market adoption of differentiated product within this 10-year period. And if so, that differentiated or better quality food would account for 1/4 of total food bought in this country.
That's a lot of stats.
I know. It's pretty aspirational,
yeah,
too, right?
It really is, yeah.
I'm telling you, buddy, that we're going to, 10 years, we're going to have 25% of food of that elevated standards. Probably not, but it's, you know, it's exciting to see what has happened in the space with craft beer, differentiated beer. I'd say that, like food stories, most people have some good beer stories, maybe one or two. Jay, you got any of those to share?
Well, I mean, come on. Like, who hasn't been through their university days, who hasn't been to happy hour, who hasn't been to, you know, a place where you're just kind of laughing up with some friends over some beers? Because, you know, beer, I think for the most part, what beer does, in my world anyway, it brings community together, right? It's sort of like this like shared social experience where, you know, you can just let go of your day, talk about what's there over a couple beers, and you just have just this wonderful way to connect, right? So you know, through college, through, you know, travels, through, you know, just meeting like random people, if you for the most part have like a beer in your hand, you can honestly start like this great conversation with folks.
It is a conversation starter. It's part of our society. It's, you ask someone to go out, get a cup of coffee or beer.
That's right.
Right? It's just on a, even if they don't drink beer, it's just a place. Yeah, it's an act. That's right.
Yeah.
My background with suds goes way back, way before I was 21 and legally able to consume them. So, you know, I was an angel, Jay. I didn't
Were
drink
you?
Before I was 21, of course.
Of
right?
course.
I wouldn't casually sip it. I would, you know, do the shotguns of opening the side of the can and drinking it that way.
Uh-huh.
I come from a Germanic background, right? So beer has been a part of my life for a long time. My father started brewing his own batches back before I was in middle school. And I remember even commandeering those empties of the good Grolsch bottles with the swing top from the restaurant that I worked at, where I was washing dishes for his home brew, what he was putting together. And you got to keep in mind that home brewing back then, 25, 30 years ago, wasn't quite what it is today. You had to be resourceful to find your ingredients, your products, and you basically made it work. In fact, we spent a good decade in my household on the hill, the apple orchard that I grew up on, where my family would host the Niederhelmen Oktoberfest. Where family, friends, pumpkin carving competitions, all and yard games, all part of the beer experience.
What still do you think happening of that? Today? Can I?
We've
can
slowed
I,
it down. Maybe we'll bring it back. A little resurgence. Would you like guys like an invite? Yeah, you're in.
Yeah, it's like a reunion of all your guests, all your co-hosts.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
What could we find for commonality to bring everybody together? Maybe beer.
Maybe beer.
All right. Yeah. Probably like a lot of you out there, memories are conjured from a long pull of hoppy IPA. It's effectively priceless. But, well, maybe it's not priceless. Maybe it's $6 worth of enjoyment, because nowadays there's so many good beers out there. How do we decide what will be used to draw those past memories and make new ones? It's a burden we're ready to endure, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I can see the taste tests happening already.
That's right. Today, we're welcoming a guest who is the founder and president of the beer company that I have chosen to be my trigger for those experiences moving forward. My personal beer right there. How about that?
There you go.
You know, made some calls. We made it happen. Today, we welcome Rob Burns, who's the president of Night Shift Brewery. Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. Rob, let me ask this to start it off. What makes your beer so good?
Oh, wow. Going right for it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's always a combination of things, but I feel like with beer and a lot of other food, you taste the passion, you taste the love behind the product, and that comes through in when a consumer tastes it. We try to make the best beer. We've always kind of used the term, how do we create better? If we're going to make an IPA, how do we make the best? And really take care for that in the creation process and the ingredients that we use and in the approach to the package. And I think you sort of already started talking about it, but I think it's much more than just the liquid inside that kind of creates that better sense.
Yeah. You know, I normally drink, and I'll name drop some of your titles here, your brand names. So I drink your IPA Centilli. And sometimes I go for your rotating hop. I'm a big sucker for the citrusy hop, right? And so you're more for one hop. When I'm feeling a little more excited and enthusiastic about stuff, I go for your double IPA, the 87. But I recently had your Night Shift Gravitas, right? That's a butt kicker.
Yeah.
Triple IPA with an alcohol percentage of 9.6%. It's smooth, though. It tastes good. It was good, but you know, I was asleep on the couch within an hour. It's kind of the old man issue. You know, we've seen a trend going in the direction of alcohol content, especially with the craft beers going significantly up. I understand the craft of that. But I want to ask the other side of that is there's also been a trend towards sessions beer. Mm-hmm. Maybe you think you have one called, I don't know if you technically define it, but a night light. Like your Bud Light, you know, good source, good product, tastes good, but lesser alcohol, lesser caloric intake, maybe no corn syrup, like Coors Light from what we learned on the Super Bowl, right? Or maybe I'm just an old man and these are my concerns, but is this a trend that everyone is experiencing in the space of these different alcohol content dictating?
Yeah, consumers kind of seem to go up and down with what they prefer, the big heavy hitters kind of getting their bang for their buck. And it's a big differentiator point from kind of the big macro beers that are usually around the 4-5% ABV. And you can just pack on a lot more flavor. For me personally, I prefer the lower alcohol beers. I'd rather have multiple and keep my head clear. And so beers like Nightlight or Whirlpool is also kind of one of our other session beers, which is 4.5%, where I can have a couple and continue that kind of social interaction with people and get home safe or not be hungover the next day. But yeah, Nightlight is our kind of answer to, like, could we create a better light beer and go after that sort of Bud Light target? Can it be more natural and not pasteurized and a little bit fresher? And that's kind of been a big new beer for us as we kind of go after the Goliath in the industry.
So Rob, obviously, you know, beer in the category of alcohol and drinking is a very saturated market, right? I mean, there's tons of options out there. And when you were, you know, working with your co-founders, what was the vision that you had that would make your brand different than what people were looking for in the grocery store?
Yeah, so when we started back in February 2012, we just crossed the 7-year kind of anniversary. One of the core tenets was to make culinary inspired beers. And what that meant at the time was to basically brew beers that weren't just the German purity law of hops, malt, yeast, and water. And we took inspiration from different ethnicities like Thai cooking and things like that to create very interesting beers. Some of the original ones had agave nectar, rye, habanero peppers. Another one had honey, green tea, orange peel. The Thai kind of one was ginger, lemongrass, and a really high sour kind of acidic profile. And those are great, and they got us a lot of notoriety. But at some point we kind of realized, well, those are great beers, but we kind of need to go back to the basics, so to speak, and produce really solid beers using those four ingredients. And we also got a better understanding of, like, you can make these really amazing, beautiful flavors out of just those four things. And hops being one of those major components of being able to produce crazy flavors from tropical to earthy to floral. To fruity, to citrusy, that are pretty amazing. And we explore that kind of in the One Hop series and Morph series and things like that.
Yeah, let's explore that a bit, because I think you're at least from my perspective, because that's what I drink, but you're mostly well-known for your IPAs.
Yep.
But that's a bit like the Labrador Retriever in a dog show, right? Yes. It's tons of competition and very high bar to make a really good IPA. So how do you differentiate your IPAs from other, and do you find that is a foot in the door for this vast $111 billion industry, which I think the industry as a collective does 2.9 billion cases?
We're much smaller than that, obviously. But yeah, the IPA is kind of the number one style in the market. In the craft market, it represents a little over 25% of what consumers are drinking if they're drinking craft. which is both exciting for us because we make a ton of them and we love them, but there's over 100 styles of beer, and sometimes I get a little disappointed that the flavor spectrum is so small. Like there's 99 other great styles of beer that I would love consumers to get turned on to and be excited about. So we last year, I think we actually produced 94 different beers. And many of them were outside the IPA realm to try to see what's out there that other people are going to latch onto. But I think a lot of what makes a great IPA has to do with quality of ingredients, the brewing and packaging processes, and cold storage. We take great pride in and freshness is another component there of from the moment the beer is packaged, it gets put into a cooler, it gets stored there. All our trucks that deliver our beer around the state are refrigerated trucks, and we often try to get our beer into the cold box at stores so that the beers are kind of at their peak brightness and freshness. And a lot of other beer distributors or smaller breweries don't have that type of cold chain logistics that we really pride ourselves on.
So you said that you made 94 different types of beers last year?
Yep.
And then, so out of that 94, how many are you making available for the consumer?
So usually at any given time that go out to the wholesale market are maybe 8 to 10. Some of them will rotate in and out, and then some of them are more permanent. The other ones were only available at our tap room. So we really use the tap room as a space for people to come and be part of our experimentation process, be part of our learning process, and give us that feedback. And, you know, we collect the data on the reviews and we collect the velocity of the sales. And if there is enough excitement around something, then it becomes a question of, should we scale this up? Can we scale this up? Do we have the raw materials to scale this up? Can we make it at an affordable price at the wholesale level and then go from there? And do we need to subtract one to add one? Which is always a tough thing because every beer at some point is kind of like your baby or your new child. And killing one off is never an easy easy call.
I'm sure there's some discussions behind the closed door. You have your favorites, right? The other yeah. founders have the favorites. And
like falling your sword for your beer.
Yeah, and yeah. Like, no. I mean, it's a little bit sad because a lot of our original beers that we started the company with no longer are in the regular rotation. And we have a lot of our core original fan base that really kind of misses that. And us too, because they sort of built the business in the early years. But as consumers' preferences and choices change, we shift it with the tides. You know, still trying to do our own take and spin on it, but it's been an evolution.
So fan base is important in this space, right? People find an affinity to your brand, having that tasting room, I'm sure letting that experience be part of this. But as you mentioned, there's hundreds of types of beer. I saw there's 7,000 different producers of beer in the U.S. alone. So that's a lot of brands. That's a lot of folks fighting for namesake and market penetration. And, you know, of the whole thing, the craft still represents, you know, the rest of it's the 87% of the Bud, Coors, Miller, Sam Adams, even in that space. What efforts do you take to attract and retain those customers to your brand?
Yeah, I mean, we try a bunch of things. I mean, the tap room is certainly a key component to us kind of getting new consumers into the brand. We do a ton of fun stuff at the brewery to bring people in, whether it is live music, whether it is community type events. You know, we do in the summer months, we do Paws and Pints where people bring their dogs and we bring a local animal charity in. We kind of raise money for that charity that night. And that creates, you know, the dog community to circle around the beer. We do yoga in the tap room. We do a running club. What else have we done? I mean, we've tried everything. We've done the paint nights and things like that are a little bit more everywhere, but really trying to make it a resource for everyone to come and hang out and be kind of an asset to the community, but also appeal to multiple ones.
So like, how would you describe like the market demographic that, you know, drinks and finds and has the community around the Night Shift brand?
The Night Shift brand, I think we touch a good varied amount. I mean, I think our core competency is probably the 25 to 45 year old. we definitely, I think, do a little better skewing a little more towards women than some other beer brands do. And, you know, we don't take that, you know, one thing I don't like about the beer industry is sometimes people go a little bit too sexist on the labels or the beer names or, you know, this and this blonde ale. It's like, come on, we're adults now. That's no longer acceptable. But so we focus on trying to talk to that. I think one of the challenges with the beer industry is, you know, it's not very culturally diverse. And that is something that the overall industry is trying to figure out. Like, how do we get other ethnicities involved? Because it is a little bit, unfortunately, too white male heavy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think we try to use some of those other ingredients in our beer to sometimes pull out or tease out different demographics as well. And Everett, where the brewery is based, has a huge Brazilian population, and we're always kind of trying to think, what is like the, you know, Brazilian fruits or flavor profiles that might appeal to the locals, myself being one of those townies now, that might get people excited. And it's a hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Like any New England town, I think you have to be like six generations deep to consider yourself a townie, though. You're still a visitor.
I'm 4 years in.
So. You're a visitor. Yeah. Yeah. You're there until your kids stay, I guess is the real things. But that is what we like about New England. There you go. You had mentioned, you know, you do introduce these fringe ingredient items, the jalapeno peppers. Some people infuse it with fruit types. There's a lot of variables that you can intertwine. But effectively, it comes down to water, barley, yeast, and hops. What I've seen from your brands and from others, especially being a fan of IPAs, is the hops are the ones that have the most variables. Finding specific hops, naming them, actually having, you know, almost like what we find in wine with grape types. Mm-hmm. That gives it a completely different flavor. What you do with those hops changes it. So I'm leading up to saying, do we have a terroir in beer?
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, I think sometimes because of the over-industrialization of the bigger, more common available beers, people forget that it is very much an agriculture product. There's year-to-year availability, and where the crop is grown has impacts on the flavor. But, you know, I mean, one of the kind of forefather hops to the craft beer movement is a Cascade hop that can be grown almost around the world. And, well, I should just generally say hops are generally thrive in areas where wine grapes thrive. And depending on where the hop is grown, it does produce different flavors. And it's pretty interesting. Like right now, Michigan Cascade hops are kind of proving themselves to be a very interesting Cascade version compared to the Pacific Northwest. And that then there's also, you know, year to year seasonal variants. And there's some like scientific measurements that they use to calculate, you know, alpha acids is one of them. But it does make it also challenging on consistency sake of, are we brewing Whirlpool the same every year when the flower is constantly changing, and the complex chemicals involved in there, the lupulin powder is also changing. And, depending on what lot or what farm we got it from could have impacts on the product. And so we do get to go out to some of the hop growing regions and actually pick like this lot from this farm, because this is going to achieve our objective better than this one. And I think you mentioned the one hop series, and that's a great one of where we went out and the Simcoe for this year, we decided that this was the Simcoe for that beer, and it might taste very different from last year, but it's still the same hop.
You know, so I have a question. So the name of the show, right, is called Sourcing Matters. And the big conversation that we have with a lot of our guests is just around how the system that we currently have either can or does support regenerative agriculture, and how there are now products that are coming out there that are now grained into the ability to, you know, source their products using more of regenerative agricultural mm-hmm. practices. And there are some beer companies that have now adapted that practice, where instead of, you know, doing the whole like monocropping, they're actually sourcing their grains through more regenerative agricultural practices. Have you noticed and or been part of those like bigger conversations as far as how, where, when the raw materials are being sourced?
Yeah, I mean, for us at a smaller scale, there's kind of just, there's definitely consolidation of like, these are kind of the malt suppliers, these are kind of the hop suppliers, and here's kind of what you got to pick. There is definitely a kind of somewhat revival to bring some of that back to the Northeast. There's, I mean, one of the components in like kind of the supply chain for at least the barley malt side is a malt house. They're really what the closest malt house I think is in, was for a while, was like in Toronto. And now there's one in Massachusetts called Valley Malt. There's one in Maine called Blue Ox. And so they are getting to start to work directly with the farmers to grow the correct type of barley, and then malt it, which is a process of turning that into a grain that's suitable for brewing, and bringing that closer to the supply chain. They're still very small companies, and neither of them could supply, you know, the industry in New England. And then similar to hops growing, most of the hops in the U.S. are grown in the Pacific Northwest. New York used to be a huge hop growing region, but there was a disease that kind of destroyed the crops. I don't want to misspeak, but it was something in the late 1800s, early 1900s that kind of wiped out that industry. I think it was like a mildew. But again, that's coming back now, as, because to some extent, the hops are a cash crop. They sell for tens of dollars a pound, and is a great, and they grow vertically instead of horizontally. But yeah, the overall industry is also getting concerned, you know, with things of like climate change. And as these growing regions shift further north, are we going to have supply issues in 10, 20, 50 years from now? And what are we doing now to protect that, so beer can be around for another 5 million years or whatever, from 5,000 BC to...
Yeah. Well, it is interesting too, because, you know, I think as people become more engaged, and we see it a lot in the food system, where, to Jay's point, that, you know, you can, this, the silver bullet of change is turning out to be our food system. That if you're an environmentalist, if you care about social structures, if you care about ethics, a lot of it comes down to how we source our food. And the regenerative models of agriculture are ways of investing back into it. But there are also ways in the methodology they use that reduce things like persistent pesticides, which immediately impact us. When you're taking neurotoxins or hormone disruptors in, it's just not a good thing. But one thing that I, maybe unrelated to the ingredients themselves, but you had mentioned the storage and the cold chain being part of this. What's up with all the cans these days? We went from everyone having bottles to a broad change within the industry. And do I really need a 16-ounce pounder versus a 12-ounce? I mean, where are my 7-ounce pony cans these days, right? Is it just a change of the industry because of a certain rationale? And are we taking correct approaches that the product being shipped in is a clean product? Are we going to get away from BPA cans?
Oh man, a bunch of stuff. I think the consumer shifted to cans maybe in the last 10 years or so, and it's been in the last maybe 2 to 3 years, it's been a pretty dramatic shift of preferring cans over bottles. I think the Brewers Association has data this year that basically shows like bottles are down 30% and cans are up 30%. Like consumers literally trade it one for the other. I think some of it, cans were not really available to the smaller craft breweries. The equipment is more expensive. The to get printed cans was more cumbersome, and the industry kind of adjusted to make that infrastructure kind of work. And the portability, the occasions that you can bring a can to are a little bit more extensive. And I think combined with a little bit more of the recyclable element to cans, help fuel it. And I think there was some kind of iconic breweries that really helped to take it off, like the Alchemist in Vermont, that really, Oscar Blues in Colorado, that really kind of showcase like, wow, cans could be really cool and the beer can be really delicious inside. And then the product quality wise, light is one of the things that most damage beer, and bottles, even dark colored bottles, let in light that light struck the beer, especially hoppy beers, and really make the beer kind of taste bad as the longer they sit on the shelf. And then the other component is oxygen. Bottle caps consistently allow a trickle of oxygen into the product that also stales the beer. And cans both are dark or impenetrable to light, and they have a double seaming process. that really make almost no oxygen possible to get into the product. So there is kind of advantages on shelf life and how the product tastes, and then the portability and recyclability. The BPA thing is a great question. That's something that the industry is looking to figure out. Can we do this without the liner in the can? I mean, I think in the 50s or whatever, they were using steel cans, and then they were using it without the liner, but then the beers tasted metallic and off. And now they don't taste it due to the liner, but there isn't currently a great solution. I know in California they have strict rules around that, and breweries have to like put a BPA warning on their on some of their cans, or at least on the shelf that they are, which is kind of interesting. And an extra sort of hurdle for the small guy, but if people are concerned, great.
It's like the cigarette packages now, right? BPAs, there is concern, right? It's infertility, it's cancer. There is concern, and especially when we're talking about something where you're already differentiating the product that's actually in the can. I mean, if it's in Coors Light, and again, that ad campaign about all the corn syrup in there, it's like, all right, I'm going to take my chances. But something of higher quality, something where I'm investing in it and the experience, I'm sure that's good to hear that at least you're looking into it and helping maybe move the industry along. I like the cans because when I'm done with them, I can just crush them on my forehead and throw them in the corner. What do you think of that, Jack?
It's not a thing anymore, Aaron.
I'm showing my age again.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that's why I'm asleep in 30 minutes, right? We recently went through a government shutdown where we lacked federal regulators looking at things like beer, new beer, other issues, no FDA, no USDA. We've got some problems there. Was Night Shift affected by that?
Yeah, we were a little bit affected. The TTB, which is the federal agency that regulates the alcohol industry, was shut down and deemed non-essential. They regulate things like if you're going to open up a new location, if you're going to start a brewery. And then they also have to approve labels and formulas, so recipes. And we had some beers that we were waiting for label approval before we wanted to move forward, and they got caught up in that mess. And thankfully, one of them just got approved, I think, yesterday. But it doesn't seem to be effective. It was like a spring summer beer that we're coming out with. But it is kind of challenging that we're one of the industries that needs a federal approval to put our can art on the can. If the beer is only sold in state, there's some other regulations where we don't necessarily need the federal. But if we're doing interstate commerce, that's where the federal comes into play and says, we need to approve this. And then the recipe side too. We also, through our distribution arm of our kind of sister business, we're trying to import some wine and spirits from Europe, and those also need federal approval on their labels, and that process has got hold up. I think yesterday we got like 3 of the 12 wines we were trying to bring in approved, so we're moving forward there now. But we were hoping to have wine on the water and headed towards us from cool wine producers that are a little more biodynamic and natural, and small producers that we're pretty excited to bring in.
Look at that. So can't buy the beer that you want, can't make it as a small business, can't ship in excellent biodynamic wine, but you can still go to a gun show and buy a gun during the shutdown. Isn't that nice?
Right, yeah.
I mean, I need a magazine clip to buy whatever I need. That is priorities. That's when I really, I get my automatic weapons out and smash the cans in my head. I'm from New Hampshire.
Shoot the cans, right?
It's a sequence of steps. Rob, what can we expect to see from Night Shift Brewery moving forward?
I mean, one of the big things that's coming down the pipeline, hopefully in March, is we're opening up a second location in downtown Boston, right next to the TD Garden where the Bruins and Celtics play.
Wow, congratulations. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's been a multi-year project for us, and it's our first time also having a restaurant component. So we'll have a full kitchen there. We'll have a smaller brewery there, and a tap room kind of setting where there's about 300 seats, and we're hoping to open that in March. And then that facility will really become the real incubation kind of test experimental playground for us, while Everett will become a little bit more of the factory component for us, for the brand, and they will kind of move through the pipeline and scale up as we feel that there's demand for that on a larger scope. So that's really exciting. We're also hoping to reopen our beer gardens. We did two beer gardens along the Charles River in August and September that were hugely successful. And it was really cool because part of the revenue from that was a revenue share with the departments of Parks and Rec and the Esplanade Association. And so people were essentially drinking beer to give back to the parks and taking over, you know, 5,000 square foot spot that wasn't generating revenue for the state, or and having that be kind of a cool experience for customers. It was awesome to watch the sunset all over the Charles River. So we're hoping to bring those back. And then the importing and bringing in some wine is another thing that we're really looking forward to. And then beyond that, we're talking about how do we take kind of our beer philosophy to other beverages, and does what we know from craft beer apply to other drinks? Like, could it be kombucha, coffee, spirits? Should we try to make cider? Should we try to make our own wine at some point? And what does that look like? And that's kind of our, you know, thinking into the future.
Fascinating. I mean, I can understand you have this unique infrastructure around your cold storage, so good opportunity to maximize that, get the revenue needed, and it continues to move along your main passion, which is brewing tremendous beer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Jay, final thoughts?
Well, again, I think going back to our sort of first conversation, right, is about, I think what you've been able to do with like the brewery and the pop-up beer gardens is bring that community, right? Yeah. I think that's what we're all sort of like looking for and striving to be around. And, you know, if you also have some good tasty beverages to share, I'm for it.
Yeah. Well, it is, as a patron, again, to hear about the lifestyle decisions, the community involvement. Although I think I've shown my hand a little bit today that maybe Rob doesn't want me as a customer at this point. Maybe. Anyway, anybody coming with
guns at home, Aaron.
Leave the guns at home. That's right. I will do so.
We're dog friendly, not gun friendly.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we can do that too. No, but I'm enthused by new products that you guys come out with and your continued interest in a lot of things that, as Jay mentioned, that we cross over in, which is the sourcing practices, the responsible sourcing and packaging products associated to your wonderful offerings. So, Rob, where can our listening audience learn more about your beers? Is the website the best place?
Yeah, nightshiftbrewing.com is the website. We're pretty active on social media. I think Instagram and Twitter, the handle is Night Shift Beer. I think Facebook, maybe the same. And yeah, we constantly have great events at the tap room, as well as our beers available at maybe 1,700 accounts around Massachusetts.
All right. Well, I will, I'll be one of those folks taking part. So I can't take you, can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I learned a great deal, Jay.
So did I.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
And our listening audience as well. So thanks again.
Appreciate it.